All right. Well, good evening, friends. It's good to be back, and not necessarily the greatest topic, as I said last time, not my favorite topic, but good to be back and good to be discussing these things. Last week was kind of the bad news, right? This week is kind of a biblical response, if you will, the biblical lay of the land, if last week was the cultural lay of the land. And once again, I will seek to be chaste. I know it's inherently an unchaste topic, but I will seek to be quite chaste. Last week, our present cultural moment, tonight, the biblical perspective, and then next week would be the church response, the pastoral response. So this is really more just kind of the biblical lay of the land. Also, by way of reminder, there are three groups that we're dealing with when we're dealing with the topic of transgenderism, and we need to keep those three groups clear in our mind because very different response to each of those groups. Remember the first group, those in very rare circumstances, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 20,000, those who genuinely experience gender dysphoria. The next group would be the activists who are promoting a predatory ideology, a wicked ideology, very different responses, right? And then that group that is inflicted with that predatory ideology, those who are suffering at the hands of kind of this cultural ideology that's being advanced. Tonight, the biblical theological alternative to last week. All right, so thinking in biblical categories then, I know this is really basic, but it's something that's really helpful, that this is God's design, that he created the male and female, as Genesis 5:2 says, and of course, Genesis 1 says, but male and female, he created them, he blessed them, and named them man when they were created. So he creates human beings, names human beings man, right? As far as the designator, that's not misogynistic to talk about, you know, mankind, right? And then in mankind, male and female, he's creating them. So this is God's given design. This is good. This is right. And actually, as we think about the created order, binary is all over the created order, if you just think about it for a moment. So at first there's nothing, and then God creates from nothing something. I mean, that's binary inherently in that, right? We have the creator and we have his creation, the creator-creature distinction. These two, it's distinct, binary. We have light and darkness. We have day and night. We have evening and morning. We have the waters above and the waters below. We have the dry land and the waters being separated. We have the sun to govern the day and the moon to govern the night. We have the creatures of the sea and the creatures, the birds of the air. So the creatures that fill those two spaces. We have work and rest. And the only time that the creation is declared not good in that beginning portion is where there's lacking binary in mankind, when there's lacking distinction. We just have male, and this is not good. It's not good for man to be alone, and so God creates females. So again, this is God's God-given design. Binary is good. Just as an aside, in marriage, there's a tendency to think that binary is not good. Right, like I want you to think like me, and that's what is like ideal or something, that we want to get the other person to think like us, when actually different perspective is beautiful and good and helpful. So too in the body, right? That there's a multiplicity added to the body. Like we don't want just uniformity and blind conformity. There's goodness in that diversity. All right. Well, that's my aside about marriage. But Satan's agenda, from the beginning, really, is to distort this distinction and God's created design that God has two, and Satan is taking pains to make the two one. No, you will be like God. the creator-creature distinction being blurred and so forth. And he wants to unite the genders in the transgender ideology. And he wants to unite the sexes in homosexuality in that ideology. But binary is beautiful, and binary is not restrictive, and binary is not oppressive. It is good, and it's right. And I know this is kind of a big word or a technical word, right? But also the way that he fashioned us as body and soul and put our bodies and souls together, that also is good. That there are two parts of man, that he forms us from the dust of the earth. He kind of makes Adam like the gingerbread man and then breathes the breath of life into him. So we have the physical component and then we have the spiritual component. And we have this unity, this psychosomatic unity, body-soul unity. So he makes us male with a coordinate male soul. He makes us female with a coordinate female soul. And so it's not possible in God's creation of a body with a fitting soul. It's not possible that God like messes up and accidentally gives a male body a female soul, or accidentally gives a female body a male soul, that he's crossing this unity. As he creates the human person, body and soul, he does so rightly as male and female, right? Like this is the way that God has made us. And this coordinate soul, you might be hearing me talk about like a male soul or a female soul, and like what on earth is a male soul? I've never seen one. I have one and I experience one, but I can't tell you what a male soul is. I've never seen a female soul, right? But I interact with my wife and my daughters and they have, you know, female souls. But anyway, I don't know what it is, you know, metaphysically, but we see it throughout the scriptures. And I'm not going to read each of these passages for you, but we see the scriptures speak of souls being engendered souls. So Moses and Elijah at the Transfiguration, when they're interacting with Christ, they are recognizable as males. The Hebrews 11 passage, we see male and female of these disembodied souls surrounding this great cloud of witnesses surrounding us, right, cheering on the progression of the kingdom of God as it advances and as we continue to run this race, right? Those in the intermediate state are known as males and females that we see there in Hebrews 11. So Sarah is still referred to as her, or Rahab as well. And we have Moses and we have Samson and so forth. I know I don't have it up there, but also the deceased saints in Revelation 14 are described as male. Again, engendered, disembodied souls there. And then in Luke chapter 20, I know I don't have it listed there, but in Luke chapter 20, verse 38, God is known as the God of the living, not of the dead, and particularly the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those who are still alive, still recognizable, even in the disembodied state as males. And so there's maleness and there's femaleness to our spirits, and that's a good thing. We have engendered bodies with a same gendered soul, even though I don't know what a male soul looks like or a female soul looks like. I just know that I experience life with a male soul, right? And then our physical body is our created reality, our given reality. Transgenderism says that my body doesn't form my reality. My identity forms my reality, and my body is simply a way I express my identity. Right? So my body is not my identity. My body's the way I express my identity, so I want to change my body to bring it in conformity to my mental identity, right? Whereas that's not the biblical perspective. The biblical perspective is that our physical body is our given reality, our creational reality, that God formed us as male or as female. And when there's confusion when there's disconnect between our mind and our physical body, if we feel uncomfortable, right, there's a disconnect there, we should look to our creational reality as opposed to seeking to change our body to conform to our thoughts and to our mental identity or something like that. I summarized last week Nancy Piercy's book, Love Thy Body, and I commended that book to you all. She has an illustration in that book about a faithful husband and pastor who struggled severely prior to his marriage with believing that he had the wrong body. He believed that he was a female, you know, had a female soul with a male body. And she goes on to share his story, and he said, instead of seeking to conform his life to his thoughts, he said, I sought to trust my body and asked the question, how has God created me? He made me male, and so how is male to relate to other males? And how is a male to relate to females? And so that's how he purposed to live, to bring his thoughts into conformity with his creational reality. Do you remember I said last week, that there are other dysphorias as well? And there's one that I said, I won't get into that, I won't mention that dysphoria, but I'll mention it now, and I think it helps as an illustration, again, that we don't conform our bodies to our mental thought processes. There's a dysphoria called body integrity dysphoria. Have you heard of this? Body integrity dysphoria. It's where people believe that they are handicapped and they are not. And so they identify as a double amputee, or they identify as a paraplegic, and they want to conduct their lives as though they are missing limbs, or they want to conduct their lives as though they're wheelchair bound when they are not. Now, good medicine would not say, therefore, let's amputate good functional limbs to bring their body into conformity with their thought process, right? Now, there are some who are arguing against the Hippocratic Oath. It says we should do no harm in medicine. No, we argue against that. We should give people what they want. But thankfully, I don't think mainstream culture were there of arguing against the Hippocratic Oath. And so, let's just amputate healthy body parts. No, we seek to provide counsel again. So bringing one's mental processes into conformity with their given reality. And that's what we do with really all things, is that we want to bring our thoughts into conformity with reality. We want to bring our thinking and our desires, our loves, our commitments, we want to bring them into conformity with what God says is true. This is actually part of the Christian life. This is part of discipleship, is I want to think God's thoughts after him. I don't want to think my own foolish thoughts. I want to think rightly about the world that God has revealed. I want to think his thoughts after him, right? I don't want to love what my foolish, fallen heart wants to love on its own and natural state of things. I want to love what God would have me to love. I don't want to hate what God calls me to love, right? I want to hate rightly as well, hate the things that God would have me to hate. And I want to be committed to the things that God would have me be committed to. So this is the very process of discipleship, is I want to be conformed in my mind, in my mental state. I want to conform that unto God. So submitting our mental reality to our created or given reality. I mentioned this book last week as well, When Harry Became Sally. And I said, this book is coming from a Roman Catholic perspective and coming from a natural law argument, but he does good science, he does good research, and he's just presenting kind of generically a moral argument and showing the dangers of the transgender movement. Again, Ryan Anderson, this was the first book banned by Amazon, and again, it's being marketed as the book that Amazon doesn't want you to read. But just briefly to summarize some elements of his argument, and then to get to one in particular, He basically shows the dangers of the transgender movement, of people being rendered sterile, of removing personal agency from people, personal choice from people at a very young age, that they're making decisions that's monumental decisions for their lives that they can't possibly be making as a 6-year-old or as a 10-year-old about really choosing to be sterile for the remainder of their life. They can't even comprehend at the age of 6 what it is to have a child and what it is to raise your own child and so forth. So that's part of his beginning argument. And then he talks at length about detransitioners, that detransitioners do exist. And he really just gives voice to people who have transitioned and have regretted it. And that's that voice, that narrative, like people just saying like, yeah, it didn't help and I wanted to go back, is a major hole in the argument against the transgender movement, right? Because the argument goes, this will prevent suicide, this will help people to calm their thoughts and to bring their thoughts into conformity with their reality and so forth, or I'm sorry, vice versa there, right? And yet it doesn't help. It's really fascinating. If you remember the debates about homosexuality in the early 2000s, when kind of that was the big cultural like hot button issue, and the main argument was those people who are born that way are that way. They stay that way. Like it's genetic, and it is just who they are. And I had a professor at Grove City College. I'm sorry, I was trained at Grove City College. I trust you'll forgive me. Anyway, I had a professor in the psychology department, Warren Throckmorton. Some of you know that name, but he did a I can't think of the word. Documentary. There you go. That's the word I was looking for. He did a documentary called We Do Exist, and it was just interviewing ex-homosexuals and just saying, like, yes, I thought I was gay, and I'm not gay. And there's something really powerful about simply presenting that narrative. Well, Ryan Anderson presents that narrative with regard to the transgender moment. And then he talks about how most, if given time, will grow out of their gender dysphoria. And he concludes his argument by the activists who are foisting their views upon the populace and how that activism is primarily targeting women's safe spaces. And it's really decaying women and their freedoms and their safety as far as now men being able to go into women's restrooms or locker rooms and men being able to compete in women's athletics and seeing that dismantled, women's athletics being dismantled. Anyway, that's just a brief summary of his overarching argument. But one of the things that he points out, and this is what I was driving toward, and this is, I think, part of the biblical argument against transgenderism. One of the things that he points out is how we are male or female down to every aspect of our being, every aspect of our biology. And again, I will be chaste, but just to present to you all of the realities of our engenderedness down to our cellular level, that we are male or female at the chromosomal level, right? Or particular hormones that are particular to the individual sexes, internal organs that are particular, external presentation that is particular, and then secondary sex characteristics like hair and facial hair, arm hair, certain, like even the feature of like Adam's apples, right? Hip size, voice depth, and so forth, that we are created male or female down to the very depths of our being, the very structural level. And so it's not possible to simply change the presentation of somebody and now they have become a different gender. We are still the same gender. Even if you change the presentation, we're still the same gender down to the cellular level. It's not possible to change that. I have a friend, he's an anesthesiologist, and he said, I literally cannot do my job as an anesthesiologist without knowing the person's gender, because they receive different amounts of anesthesia to keep them under, depending upon whether they're male or female. So I need to know their biology, right? All right, so if this is how God has created us, I said last time that we will also talk about, but what about the exceptions? What do we do when there is, like, you know, as far as people being born, there's an out-of-alignment experience? And remember I said that we don't argue from the exceptions to the norm, but we argue from the norm to the exceptions. But what do we do when somebody is born intersex, or what has historically been called hermaphrodite or hermaphroditism? That's a term that has been thrown out. Apparently, that's not politically correct. So intersex, when somebody might be biologically male but presents as a female, like what do we do with these exceptions to the rule? Well, again, if we are created down to the cellular level, male or female, the goal with those exceptions then is to bring ourselves into alignment to our creational reality so far as we're able to do so. So far as medical science would allow us to do so, to bring the person into conformity with how we have been created as male or female. We will face deformities, we will face handicaps and difficulties in our bodies because of the fall, right? And for people to be born with a particular handicap or deformity, again, the goal is to use medical science so far as we're able to alleviate that handicap or alleviate that deformity. And so too in the case of intersex, how can we bring an intersex person in as closely in alignment with their creational reality as possible? I didn't mean for all of these to appear at once, but we'll move bullet by bullet here as far as thinking about a biblical gender expression. I have there the Joan of Arc phenomenon. Leslie Feinberg is a transgender, was, sorry, she's deceased, a transgender activist and author who is largely attributed with making gender studies mainstream. And she was famous for arguing that Joan of Arc was actually transgender. She said that Joan of Arc wasn't like a French military hero and a martyr for her faith, but a transvestite who broke gender norms by dressing as a man and battling as a man, and that's what got her killed. Well, that idea has begun to permeate academia, especially literary theory and gender studies. And basically what is taking place is women are being told that if they're assertive, if they're visionaries, if they're athletic, if they're powerful, well, then you're trans, or you're likely trans. And tragically, do you see what that does to women? That if you're good at something, you're probably a man. Like, it takes away women's uniqueness and women's abilities and women excelling and so on and so forth. And that brings us to the second bullet point there. Remember what I said last week about Nancy Piercy saying that the entire range of human personality traits is open to both sexes, that it's okay to be different from prevailing social norms. So we need to see that the range of human personality is experienced through my maleness, or, you know, for someone who's a female, through their femaleness. And that is a good thing, and that is a fine thing. And we don't have to put people into cultural stereotype boxes to say, if you don't meet that cultural norm, well, then you're probably a different gender. If we see the biblical beauty of the range of human personality expressed through our maleness or our femaleness, like, that reclaims this space. So as we think about common human properties expressed through our maleness or femaleness, think about gentleness. That's not uniquely feminine. I hope that's unique to us as the people of God and the gentleness that we express, the fruit of the Spirit. Or what about courage? That's not uniquely masculine. We want men and women to be courageous, or initiative, or nurturing, or patience, or protectiveness. These things are not gender specific. This is Christian character, or some of them are the fruit of the Holy Spirit. Or what about self-sacrifice, right? Or even submission, right? As the scriptures call us to submit to one another, that these things are not uniquely male or uniquely female. And so there's a sense in which we need to get past the cultural stereotypes, again, to think that if you're not in that box, that, well, then I guess you must be a different gender. And so then the culturally shocking paradigm of Ephesians 5, I don't know if we've often seen the shocking language of Ephesians 5. And of course, liberal scholarship will take this to places biblically we cannot go and we ought not go, but we still need to see how first century shocking this is. And if you think about speaking into a Roman culture where wives were viewed horribly, that wives were for children and mistresses were for fun and so forth, like just awful perspectives of the home in Roman culture. And here Paul is speaking into that culture. And here I want to listen to this language that I know you're very familiar with, but Ephesians 5:25. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. I want you to think about the language that Paul is employing and giving to husbands there. The language of loving, of cleansing, of washing with water, of presenting one without spot or wrinkle and without blemish. That language is intentionally domestic responsibilities of a mother doting over her children. That she would wash her children, she loves her children, cares for her children, she cleanses her children, she irons the clothing for her children without spot or wrinkle to present her children to the onlooking world in a way that is, you know, well-presented kind of thing. That's the imagery that the Apostle Paul is leveraging and saying, in the same way that wives would, or mothers would dote over their children and care for their children, so too husbands, you ought to care for your wives in such a way. It is radically, culturally breaking of molds, right? And saying, serve one another in these radical ways. And so it's not like, oh, you know, Paul's calling men to be effeminate or something, or like, oh, I guess, you know, trans husbands or something. That's what Paul is calling them to be. No. Biblical Christianity, true masculinity is serving. True femininity is serving. It's using your gifts and your talents and your personality and the uniqueness of who you are to serve and care for those in your personal orbit. I mean, that's biblical manhood and biblical womanhood, not cultural gender stereotypes that we need to conform to certain norms. Or again, or some other gender. So then, kind of coming to a beautiful vision again, I don't know why all my bullet points are showing up all at once, but they are. A beautiful vision, a positive vision. We need to reclaim biblical sexuality, a positive vision for sexuality. And by sexuality, I mean it in the most basic sense of the way that the sexes interact with one another, the way that males interact with males, the ways that males interact with females, the way that females interact with females, the way that females interact with males. That's sexuality in its most basic level, right? And intimacy is only a very small fraction of that. So sexuality involves maleness and femaleness, of imaging God and how we relate to one another, again, for God's purposes. And both genders are necessary for rightly imaging God. That is beautiful and glorious that God created us male and female. I don't have the passage here explicitly written down in my notes. I don't know why. But that he created them male and female. It's not just that he created males in the image of God, but male and female, he created them in the image of God. And both are necessary for rightly imaging God. And then we also need to reclaim the beauty of what it is to be brothers and sisters. God wants us to relate well in our engendered reality as husband and wife, as mother and father, as co-worker and boss and so forth, you know, in that sense of superior, inferior that the Lord has given. But the primary way that we relate in our created reality, in our engendered reality, the primary relationship that we have as far as what is most common, it's that of brother and sister. And you might say, well, yeah, but the pinnacle of relationship, that's husband and wife. But even in husband and wife, we are brother and sister in the Lord. And so brother and sister is the most common or the prevailing way of relating to one another. And unfortunately, in our culture, I think we've lost that. In our culture, everything is condensed down to sexuality and, like, not the way I'm using it, like a hyper-sexuality of seeing things in, like, an over-romanticized way. Do you ever have this experience that, I know this isn't exactly transgenderism, but bear with the illustration for a moment. Do you ever have the experience where you see two guys, like, going out to eat together and you think, well, I wonder if they're gay? Like, why is that in our culture? Or you see somebody out to eat, not with their wife, and you wonder, oh no, is that okay, when it's actually their biological sister or something? Why is it that in our culture there's a hyper-sexualization of everything? And I think it's because the world cannot conceive of a depth of love and intimacy that is not romantic. And the Lord has reclaimed this beautiful space. I mean, it's his space, this brother and sister in the Lord, that yes, in one relationship, the husband and wife relationship, romance would be compelled, but in all other relationships, it would be constrained. And that's beautiful. That's glorious. So we need to reclaim the beauty of brothers and sisters in the kingdom of God. We need to reclaim the notion of being able to relate to one another in our maleness and in our femaleness through the full range of human personality, and not try and constrain those experiences to a cultural expression or cultural stereotype. After all, the brother and sister relationship will be the primary relationship in glory, perfectly chaste, male and female in our engendered reality, as Jesus says in Luke 20, 34 through 36. Jesus said to them, "The sons of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy to attain to that age and to the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, for they cannot die anymore because they are equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection." So again, I don't know what it is to be a disembodied male spirit in the intermediate state, and I don't know what it looks like to be a disembodied female spirit in the intermediate state, but all I know is that we will be male and female interacting with one another, not in the marital relationship, but in the brother-sister relationship in perfect chastity, and that binary is beautiful and wonderful, and it continues for all of eternity. It's not like we become like this amalgam of like oneness and one gender or something like that in glory. No, we remain brothers and sisters for all of eternity. And so we need to reclaim the beauty of our engendered reality.